Christians who are under fire. We have a number of guests here tonight. I'm just going to briefly introduce the book so we can appreciate chapter 16. This book is unlike any other book of the New Testament in that it is written in symbolic language. You do not take it literally as you do the book of Luke, let's say, or the book of Acts, a biography of Jesus in the first case, history of the church in the second case. When you read the book of Revelation, you're reading a word picture. John is seeing these grand visions from God that reveal information that relates to the immediate future history of the church. The first verse of the book is important in order to interpret the entire book, where it says that John received a message that it was sent and signified by his angels, things which must shortly come to pass. So it was written in sign language or signified, and whatever the message of the book is, it was something that was to shortly come to pass. Tonight we're going to talk about the day or the battle of Armageddon, and you might be surprised to find out that the only place in the Bible that that word Armageddon is used is in Revelation chapter 16 and verse 7. It's found one time in all the Bible, but how many times have you heard it referenced? How many times have you heard of people talking about the Battle of Armageddon as if it were a major theme of the Bible? We're going to talk about what it means tonight, but I wanted to remind us as we begin this study that this is a book of symbolic language, and it relates events that were to occur sometime shortly after the writing of the book, probably, if we're interpreting its symbols correctly, in the next 200 years or so after the book was written, in the persecutions that the Roman government brought against the church, trying to extinguish the church. But ultimately, it was the Roman government that capitulated instead of the church that went under, because Constantine, AD 313 to 325, he decided he would become a Christian instead of the other way around, where there were no Christians and there was no church. Now that's just a brief summary, but whatever the symbols of the book mean, I hope that when you read this book, and I hope that you will read it, for Revelation 1:3 says there's a blessing that comes from reading it. And when you read it, don't get so bogged down in trying to figure out what every little detail was of this horn or this woman that's dressed with the sun or whatever the image, but stand back from it and recognize that the message is God wins in the end. Just be faithful. If you know that, then you know what the book of Revelation is all about. Now let's go into Revelation chapter 16 and go through the second half of this chapter that deals with the seven bowls of the wrath of God. Now the book of Revelation has a number of images, but they're not just pulled out of the air. If a person was familiar with the Old Testament and the history of the Jews, then he would be able to interpret most of the vision just by going back and seeing what the original reference to this event or this particular, in this case, animals and insects, what it represented in the thinking of those who had lived under the Old Testament. For instance, in chapter 16, we've talked about last week that the 10 plagues of Exodus chapter 7 through 12 is really the key to the map of understanding Revelation 16, because we are finding that the same images are used in this chapter as were found in those 10 plagues. Tonight we're going to talk about number 2 and number 9 on the list. They're not in the same order, but some of the same ideas are communicated. I think I'll just put these up here for benefit of those who like to take notes, and you can have the reference, and on your own time, perhaps this week or next week sometime, you may want to go back and review. I reread these and found it interesting, some of the details that are easily forgotten that make it a lot more interesting and help us to understand what we're studying here. For sake of time, let's just dive right in. I want to try to finish this chapter tonight. So let's pick up at Revelation 16:10. And the fifth angel poured out his vial or bowl. The word literally means a shallow dish. So the picture is that God is handing these bowls of his anger, and he's giving them to his seven different messengers or angels, and then they have a specific target to pour their bowl upon. We saw that the first one poured it upon the sea, and it turned to blood as a dead man. And the second one, earlier in this chapter, poured it upon the fresh water, and it turned to blood. And then, and here, just to speed up the process, we're going to see another target in verse 10. Poured his vial upon the seat of the beast, and his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues for pain. The beast is the reference to chapter 13, verse 2, where we studied earlier, where you had the dragon who had two allies with him. The dragon is identified in this book as Satan. And so Satan has two allies that are doing his bidding. Well, who were those two allies? One was civil government. The Roman government was the leading persecutor against the church. The Caesars desired to be worshipped. They required by law that each citizen in their worldwide empire burn incense to the statue of the Caesar who was then living and in power. And if you refused to do that, then you would not be given a labellus or a certificate that would allow you to run a business or at sometimes in history even be able to go to the marketplace and buy and sell. So it became very hard to get a job or even to take care of day-to-day activities if you did not capitulate and worship Caesar. Now, there was a second beast, and that beast was identified as pagan religion. And these two worked together because the religion or the empire, the Roman Empire, as they would conquer all these different nations, they just let the people keep their own gods. They didn't force them to worship but as long as they would go along with Caesar worship, then they could keep their other gods. And so there were so many different gods to be worshipped, but all of these different idolatrous religions then were willing to go along with one more idol, but the Christians were not. They worshiped the true God of heaven who forbid idolatry, so they could not worship the image of the beast or the image of the empire, and thus the government and false religion brought their powers down upon the Christians to try to destroy the church. Now here you see that the Christians who are facing this kind of persecution, who are fearing for their lives, who know those who've already died or been in prison because of persecution, they're praying to God to relieve them from this. And so this message will be very encouraging to them. At some point in the future, God is revealing, I'm going to pour out my wrath upon the seat of the beast, upon his very throne. So that's what they were asking for. Would you do something about this emperor who is persecuting us and killing us? And God says, be patient. Just wait. And then we've been seeing that since chapter 6. God, in measured punishments, had tried to bring about repentance, but that didn't work. And so now he's pouring out an unmitigated, his wrath undiluted upon the Roman, in this case, the seat of the beast. Now, the second part of verse 10, poured out his vial upon the seat of the beast. So this is going to be a judgment, a political judgment against the Caesar. Now, the next part, and his kingdom was full of darkness. The implication there is that if you have corrupt government or a corrupt leader, then that is going to trickle down, or that's going to affect those who are led by this leader, or those who are under the authority of this government. In Proverbs 14:34, the Bible says that righteousness exalts a nation, but what? Sin is a reproach to any people. So what is it that has made our nation great? Well, you could not rule God out of that equation, could you? We were a God-fearing nation. Not that all were Christians, but at least there was respect among the founding fathers and a majority of those that crossed the seas to come here to want to just practice what the Bible said, just to have freedom of religion. And that led to the great government that we live under tonight. But we can see that in some areas this our freedoms are being reduced, and our leaders have disappointed us in many ways. And so if you have corruption in government, then you cannot have for a long time a righteous society beneath it. That's what you had here. When you had the wickedness of a pagan Caesar on the throne, then you were going to have darkness throughout the land. There was going to be a result from that. Now, this seems to be taken from a couple of Old Testament passages. For instance, Psalm 69:23 talks about darkness, a lack of wisdom, or judgment. How important it is to have good judgment when you're a leader, a civil leader, a president, a governor, a senator, whatever office. You think about when Solomon became king and God gave him the opportunity, I'll give you a gift, whatever you want, 1 Kings chapter 3. Remember what Solomon asked for? Not riches, not a long reign, not a peace for with his enemies. What did he ask for? He wanted wisdom. Because he felt as a little child, you know, the weight of this was coming down upon him. No doubt there was a lot of excitement. He was going to be a king. He was a king now. He had all this power and all these opportunities and all these people looking to him. But he also felt the responsibility. He said, I need wisdom. And every leader who has ever reigned or ruled or been elected needs wisdom. But if one turns back to the Word of God, then his primary source of wisdom is not in his thinking. And so if the Bible is light and you close the Bible, what do you live in? If the Bible is light and you close the Bible, what do you rule with? Darkness. And if you rule with darkness, what happens to those who rule? You see, that's the thought in the middle part of verse 10, that because of the moral corruption of the Caesars, and they were, if you do any history study of the Caesars, they were morally bankrupt individuals. There's just hardly any sin that these Caesars did not practice and did not do. They were willing to do anything. And so when you had that kind of leader, then you had darkness in the land. And if you have moral corruption, if a person can be bribed or can't be trusted to keep his word, then how can you build trust with the people? And how can that not affect the righteousness? And righteousness builds a strong society, builds a strong family, builds a strong church, builds a strong life. If you don't have righteousness, then you can't have long-term strength. You can't trust in business, for instance. If you can't trust the guy you're selling to or buying from, then if he's cheating, you see how that corruption just makes for a weak nation. That's what it's saying here. And if you read a history of Rome and why it fell, included in any history, you could pick up any of the standard works, they would include natural disasters as one of them, and we saw that in the first part of the chapter. They would also include moral wickedness of the rulers. So those two things contributed to the fall of the Roman government eventually, and you see that prefigured here in these bowls being poured out upon the enemy of God's people. So the next part says, and his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues for pain. Some of you weren't here for the first part of the chapter, but the first bowl that was poured out caused sores to come upon them, and they were hurting with the sores. And then the fourth one was the sun, and it scorched the people, so it added insult to injury. And so now that there's a third layer of pain, and they're in so much pain that they're gnawing their tongues. So it's just, the figure is just one of total misery and a desire to be rid of what's bothering them. This chapter 16, verse 2, and this phrase, gnawed tongues, occurs only here in the New Testament, according to one source. But instead of repenting, you know, when someone gets knocked to their knees, Abraham Lincoln said, I've often been driven to my knees because I felt there was nowhere else for me to turn. But sometimes when people are driven to their knees, instead of praying to God, they curse God. And that's what you had here. They blamed or blasphemed God for these problems that were happening instead of dealing with the source of them, that is their own sin. They're dealing with the consequences. All right, let's move then into verse number 11. And blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores and repented not of their deeds. Verse 12. So we've talked about the fifth angel, now let's talk about the sixth one out of seven. And the sixth angel poured out his vial or bowl upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. We saw this earlier in chapter 9, verses 13 and following, that there were four angels that were bound in the river Euphrates, and they were not allowed to do what they were commissioned to do until the people, the God's people were protected. And when we discussed that, we talked about how that the Euphrates River was a natural boundary for the Roman Empire. If it was going to be attacked, it was very hard to attack from the east because of that great river. It was dangerous. Getting your army and your equipment across was difficult. So in this case, when the Euphrates is pictured as being dried up, it would be easy. You would be defenseless. You would have one of the barriers to being attacked done away with. Now remember, this is a book, this is a figurative book. It's not necessarily talking about a literal river Euphrates literally being dry, but the idea is that God is going to knock down their defenses so that they're more easily destroyed. That the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. There are two ideas about this in if you read the commentaries, and they can't both be true. Sometimes you can say, well, maybe either one's true. One of the ideas is that the kings that are the last part of the verse, the way of the kings of the east might be prepared, is that it represents Christ and those carrying on his business. In other words, eventually destroying the Roman Empire. The other one is that, tying it to verse 14, that there is a connection between the Roman government and those that he is ruling, the lesser nations or cities, that he is using as his allies against the church. And actually, when we get to verse 14, it may make more sense. It seems like the second of those, either one of them could be true. If you tied what we've studied from verses 10 through 12 with that figure, then it would be the previous interpretation. But if you tie it to what's following, then it would be the second. Probably it's going to be the second one, but I'll let you make that decision as we go through this, further into this discussion. But also, well, let's just read 13. I'll point out that we're beginning a third section in verse 13. We pointed out in the beginning that the phrase "and I saw" or "and I looked" are three times used in this text. Each one of them is a new section. So verse 13, "And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet." Well, there are a lot of fanciful interpretations of that passage. You could pick up just about any denominational commentary and come up with some really far out interpretations of Hitler or Mussolini or more modern or more ancient leaders represented by these three frogs. Let's just talk about first what it says in the context of the Bible, and then we'll try to determine what it means. Frog is the only place in the New Testament you find the word frogs. It's nowhere else to be found in the New Testament. It is found in the Old Testament. In the book of Exodus, as you can see there, Exodus 7:25 through 8:11, when the Egyptians who worshiped frogs, incidentally, and they were pretty tired of frogs by the end of this second plague, they had swarms of frogs that came up. Psalm 78, verse 45 says that they were destroyed by frogs. Now we can understand how the locusts destroyed the Egyptians because they ate all the produce of the field. But frogs, they're a nuisance, but they're not poisonous and they're not destroying, you know, they're not eating up your crops. So in what sense did they destroy them? Well, maybe they spread disease, or maybe it was just in the sense that they demoralized them. They're also mentioned in Psalm 105, verse 30, also a reference back to the Egyptian plague. So only those times in the Bible, Exodus and twice in Psalms and Revelation. So there's not a lot of context to be able to draw from to find a legend to interpret this from Scripture. They would fall in the class of animals found in Leviticus 11 verse 9 with skin, an unclean animal. So, under the law of Moses, you couldn't eat a frog, Of course, we've been delivered from that law today, and it's not forbidden for us, but it was for them. All right, let's move on then to an interpretation of what this means. We've seen already that this is the unholy trinity, if you wanted to say it that way, of the dragon and the sea beast and the land beast. Dragon representing the devil, the sea beast coming out of society, the sea of society representing the Caesar or the Roman government, and the land beast representing false religion. We saw that when we interpreted an earlier vision. So here you have this unholy trinity, and from these three come three frogs or three demons, unclean spirits. What does it mean? It seems to be this, in a nutshell, boil it all down. Satan, government, and false religion decide to strengthen their position by gathering their allies in this great battle, Armageddon, against God. So they can see the handwriting on the wall, and there, instead of going down easy or surrendering, they say, we're going to put up as much of a fight as we can. And so they begin to muster the forces. And in this case, the forces are all those that are under their control. In the case of the government, all these other nations and all these other kings that they have who are going along with the government and the false religion. It says working miracles in that verse, the next verse, for they are the spirits of devils, King James, demons. There's one devil and many demons. King James uses devils in the sense of little devils. They carry out the will of Satan, but demons is the better translation. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles. Now, no representative of Satan can work a true miracle, but they are deceivers. You see that in several places, and we studied a few lessons on this, and if you want to go back on the website, you could listen to those if you weren't here, but I'll just give you three references without taking time to go over and read them since we've covered them recently. Matthew 24, 24, to deceive, if it were possible, even the elect. So there are some very convincing false teachers and false actions. We talked about the charismatics and so forth in previous lesson. 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 9 and 1 Timothy 4 1. Those passages would be parallel with this phrase, working miracles. All right. So the image is, the unholy trinity of the dragon and the sea beast, land beast, are sending out messengers. Everyone gather at Armageddon for this great battle. And what does it mean? Well, let's talk about that. The next part, verse 14, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. See there, you see what we were saying earlier? They're gathering their forces together to fight against God. So everyone come. It would be like in World War II, the United States was not in the war, we were hesitant to get in the war, and our allies kept saying, we need help. Churchill's petitioning us. So we didn't want to be in the war. We had already been in a war. And then Pearl Harbor, and so we were in. That's the figure here is the allies are saying, come help us, come help us. Except in this case, the Caesar has the authority to say, you're going to come and help us because you do what I tell you. I'm the world leader. Verse 15, behold, this is an interlude. This is a message to the Christians, and sometimes preachers do this. We'll be preaching along on one subject, and then we'll say, by the way, that reminds me, and we'll say, just a Senate sermon, or just a reminder. Well, that's what you have here. In the middle of this great prophecy, you have this warning, or this admonition, this encouragement to Christians. Because this is going to happen, this is something you need to be reminded of at this point. And this is always good advice for Christians, so it would be good at any time. But in this context, it makes sense. Behold, I come as a thief. In other words, Jesus is saying his coming in judgment against this force we're talking about is going to be unexpected. it's also true of the judgment day. We've studied lessons before on how in the twinkling of the eye, 1 Corinthians 15:53-57, Jesus says his coming will be that quick. So your only way to know you'll be ready when Jesus comes is to always be ready, because there's no way to know ahead of time when he's coming. So that's the idea here. But it's not talking about the end of time. Here, he's talking about he's coming in judgment on the Roman Empire. I'll come as a thief. It'll be unexpected. So, blessed is he that watcheth. The ETH ending, if you're using Old King James Version, is an indication of a verb tense in the original that is that continues. That's helpful. So sometimes it's a little hard for a new Christian or someone who's not familiar with the Bible. Those ETH endings give them a hard time. But if you know what it means, it could be very helpful, because it indicates more than you can see in the English word watches. And you could go look it up and you can get the same message from it either way, but it helps to see it right there in the text. This is a continuing event. In other words, you didn't just watch when you became a Christian, you're watching your past. This is something you do on a daily basis. Watcheth and keepeth his garments. So vigilance and purity are the two necessities urged upon us here. We have to constantly, we can't let our guard down against the devil. You know, if you're walking in enemy territory, you're constantly looking, constantly watching what's coming my way, what danger is there, what temptation. So here we are, we're always in enemy territory. This is the devil. The devil's land where we are. And so always be watching. Every day when you go to work, when you're at play, when you've got your TV on, when you're listening to your music, when you're, you know, whatever the circumstances, there can be a temptation there. So watch. Be on guard. Don't let your guard down and fall into sin. And the second part, keepeth his garments. I guess that may not communicate as well to us as it did then, but what it means is don't get your clothes dirty. Don't be spotted. James 1:27, pure religion undefiled before God and the Father is this, the visit fathers and the widows in their affliction. And, somebody finish it, keep himself unspotted from the world. We've all had this happen. You have on your good dress or your good shirt, and you go out to lunch. Oh, catch up on my good tie, you know, or I got a spot on my new dress. You know, we've all had it spotted. Well, the same thing can happen to the soul. We spot ourselves by impurities or by sin. So Jesus is warning here in this great battle that's ongoing, don't forget to be vigilant. Don't let the devil pull you away from what's right. And don't lose your purity. Sexual purity, mental purity, life purity. It's not just talk about one of them, but just in general. Don't let sin come back into your life after you've been washed clean. It's the same figure you see in 2 Peter 2:20-22, as the dog that was... as the sow that was washed to her wallowing in the mire. So don't go back. God's cleaned you up. Don't go back and get dirty and sin again. That's the idea. Lest he walk naked and they see his shame. That idea comes from chapter 3:4. We are to be spiritually clothed just as we're to be physically clothed. And if we don't add the Christian attitudes, then we're spiritually naked just as we could be physically naked. So he says, don't fail to be what you're supposed to be, but add those fruit of the Spirit would be one list in Galatians 3:21-22. All right, let's move on to the next one. Notice that there is shame associated with nakedness there. In this case, it's a spiritual application, but the physical, it would not be true spiritually if it weren't first true physically. Verse 16, and he gathereth them together into a place called, in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. The only time that word is found in the Bible. If you have a modern translation, it may have an H on it, Armageddon. King James says it begins with an A. What it means is Mount Megiddo, or Hill of Megiddo. There's a famous place in the Old Testament. Here's the legend to interpret this vision. We won't take the time to do this, but if we had time, we'd go back and... But I think the shorthand will be enough for many in here. One Bible geography textbook said that Jezreel, that is the plain that's in front of Mount Megiddo, is the most famous battlefield of the antique world. That's Hurlbut's book on Bible geography. Keep that in mind. I'm going to give you why that's the case now. These are all Bible battles that took place at or near Mount Megiddo. Deborah and Barak defeated Jabin and Sisera in Judges chapters 4 and 5. You may remember that Deborah drove a nail through his temples, and that recorded in Judges 4 and 5. Two, Gideon's 300 men fought near here, just west of here, Judges 7 verse 1 beginning. Three, Saul and Jonathan were killed at the eastern extremity of the plain, 1 Samuel 31, 1 through 6. King Azariah died here, 2 Kings 9, 27. And number five, the last one, King Josiah, who was one of the few righteous kings, you may remember, after Solomon, died here when he, Pharaoh Necho was coming up from Egypt. I'll give you the references because I forget. 2 Kings 23, 29, beginning. Pharaoh Necho was coming up. This is a historic battle of significance in history. If you go back to the Old Testament, you know that the world ruling empires were Egypt, Assyria, Babylonia, Medo-Persia, and then the Romans, the Greeks and the Romans. Well, these two, between the Assyrians and the Babylonians, Pharaoh Necho was an ally of the Assyrians. Egypt was. So Pharaoh is bringing his army up to join in a battle with Babylon. King Josiah takes his little army out and meets him at Megiddo and slows him down. King Josiah is killed there, but he slows him down enough that he doesn't get there in time, and Babylon defeats Assyria, and the world power swings to Babylon over Assyria. And just a tidbit of history. It was interesting. But anyway, that King Josiah died there. There really was no strategic reason for him to be in that battle. When you look at it, he could have just let the Pharaoh go through his land. They would not have been harmed by him. But he has to join in, and he gets killed. At any rate, that's beside the point for what we're studying tonight. So here is the shorthand of what does Armageddon mean? What does that symbol mean in the Bible? Here it is. To make a great final stand. That's all it means. You want to expand it? You could say it this way. This is how Homer Haley says it in one of the textbooks we're using. Thus, a great decisive battle between the army of Satan and the forces of God, which would determine the fate of each. So the shorthand version is, if we do this with battles too, we say someone met his Waterloo. What do we mean by that? Well, we're not talking about going over to Belgium and finding the battlefield where Napoleon was defeated and say we met our end in that location. When we say somebody met his Waterloo, we mean he fought his last battle. That was it. We do the same thing with Gettysburg. Or Bunker Hill, and shorthand in American history. Same thing. Gettysburg was a turning point in the Civil War. Bunker Hill, turning point in the Revolutionary War. So, that's shorthand. We use it as symbolic language. That's what is being done here. It means a final last stand that will determine everything. All the chips are on the table. This battle is going to be either one way or the other. When it's done, the war's over. That's what the Battle of Armageddon is. So will God win or will Satan win? That's the big question. All the forces are gathered together at this famous place. Megiddo is not really a mountain so much as it's a plateau. It's about 14 to 20 miles, depending on where you're measuring, a plateau. So it's a big battlefield. And so that's the way it was sometimes used. And also the plain of Jezreel that joined it. often would be the place where the battles would either begin or end. All right, if you want to know who won, you read Revelation 19, 11, and 21. Rome lost, God won. But you knew that before you came tonight. But that's where you find, you don't actually find a description of the Battle of Armageddon in the Bible, but you do find the results of it. And that's in chapter 19. When we, if we get there, when we get there. I will say before we move on from verse 16, since there is so much confusion on this, this does not refer to a future physical battle in Palestine. There's no support in Scripture that there's going to be some battle of Armageddon at some time in the future on earth. Whatever this is talking about, as we began our study tonight, we talked about Revelation 1 verse 1, said these things will shortly come to pass. Well, it's already been 2,000 years. That could not, by any definition of shortly, be what this is talking about. 200 years, the Rome and the immediate context that the Christians were dealing with, certainly, and as we've seen in this section of the book of Revelation, he's dealing with the events that occurred in first century into those Christians that would live in the coming days immediately after and under the same government as those that were receiving this message initially. All right, verse 17. Let's see the seventh angel. I'm going to go really quick in this last section. The seventh angel poured out his vial or bowl into the air. So now we have all four elements. We have sea, rivers, sun, or fire, and now the air. What does air mean? The key to interpreting this is probably Ephesians 2 verse 2, which refers to Satan as the prince of the power of the air. It's an interesting thought. What it seems to mean is, this is Satan's domain. It says in Acts chapter 17, speaking, when Paul is speaking on Mars Hill, as talked about a little bit Sunday, in whom we live and move and have our being. Well, there's a sense in which we are living and moving and having our being on Satan's battlefield, because this is where he has his, he's the God of this world, 2 Corinthians 4 verse 4. So when this is poured out in the air, then that reaches the larger expanse of the influence of Satan in the Roman world. And there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven, so that would be God's voice, from the throne saying, "It is done." That's it, I'm finished. Seven punishments, that's all I'm going to do. But this time it was not measured punishments. Earlier when we saw he was doing the trumpets, it was one-third of the earth will be hurt or injured or killed. But this time, it's undiluted. It's full measure. God has reached the end of his patience. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings. There was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. Figurative language is recognizing how this judgment was not something that would go unnoticed. It was something that would be tremendous and would be world-altering. 19, and the great city was divided into three parts. There's different ideas about what the three parts here means. There's a verse in Ezekiel that says, I'll try to give it to you, but what it says is that when they conquered the land, this is Ezekiel chapter 5, one-third of the city was, the inhabitants of the city were burned. One-third were killed with a sword, and one-third were scattered to the wind. That may be what it's talking about, but the picture is it's totally destroyed. Whatever the three, maybe they just divided it and broke it into three sections and destroyed it one at a time. But the idea is of destruction. Now the next part, and the cities of the nations fail. We've been talking about Babylon, we've been talking about the throne of the beast, but now you have the satellite cities involved. When we were studying earlier about the seven churches of Asia, and we did some geographical studies about the locations of each one, one of the things that we noticed as we went through each of that is how that some of these places were outposts for the Roman government, where they would be the seat of Satan, where you would have, much like our county seat, you know, one city among several cities in a region is the main city. It's the government headquarters there in that area. Well, they had the same thing in the Roman government. Rome was the main, it was Washington, D.C., but then you also had these smaller places that were the regional headquarters. So that seems to be what these other cities are referring to that carried out the will of the beast. The nations, they fell also, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God. Do you remember when you read Acts chapter 10, it said that Cornelius' prayers were a memorial to before God? You may remember reading in Genesis when God remembered the earth during the time of the flood. Well, God is omniscient, so he doesn't have to be reminded. He doesn't ever forget anything. But this is figurative language that is saying, okay, this is next on the docket. This is what God's dealing with right now. This is the time has come down to zero, and God's going to take care of this one. So that's the idea here, that it came up to remembrance to God. He remembered the promise. He never forgets what he says he's going to do, and so he carried it out. To give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. And there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent, about 95 pounds. Different numbers will be given, but that seems to be the most accurate. And men blasphemed the name of God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof was exceeding great. Of course, there's another one of the references to the 10 plagues of Egypt. The figure there is just that the judgment is complete and God is going to eventually appease or balance the scales of justice. His children have been persecuted. His church has been injured, but eventually he's going to right the scales of justice. The Roman government would not outlast the church. All right, that's all our time. I appreciate your attention and your attendance tonight. We'll take a break and for just a moment.